The Arizona Coyotes and the city of Glendale are continuing their battle over a contract signed 2 years ago, and the team's ownership picture is changing dramatically. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about what steps are next and why the National Hockey League is so committed to keeping the Coyotes in the Valley. When the league owned the team, it could have sold them to an investor who wanted to move the organization to another market, but that didn't happen. NHL Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly will try to clear up the picture. Also, businessman and reality TV star Donald Trump and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush have joined the very crowded Republican presidential field. And Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign is gathering momentum. Are there any candidates that especially appeal to Arizona voters? We'll talk about it. And author Tom Clancy's books became extremely popular and were praised by many for their accuracy, as well as their plots. I'll talk with Valley novelist Grant Blackwood, who has stepped into Clancy's shoes as the new writer of the Jack Ryan Jr. series of books. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. Two scientists hope to fund a research center in Lake Havasu City to better understand how to manage the lake that provides drinking water to millions in Arizona and Southern California. KJZZ's Dennis Lambert has more.
Plant biologist David Young, the president of Arizona State University at Lake Havasu, says he'll ask officials at the main university campus in Tempe for seed money to develop a premier research center focusing on Lake Havasu and the lower Colorado River. Young and Doyle Wilson, the city's water resources coordinator, tell today's News Herald of Lake Havasu they're confident the seed money can be found. Wilson says five major areas of research are planned, including quagga mussels, microcystis, which are the algae blooms locals refer to as the green slime, and nutrients in the lake. Wilson says the studies are not so much about academics as understanding how to better manage Lake Havasu, which provides drinking water for millions of people. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
Coconino County's first subdivision proposal in 7 years is moving forward this summer. The Arizona Daily Sun reports the Board of Supervisors will consider on August 18th a 115-acre project that would put 61 lots on land flooded after the 2010 Schultz fire. Plans for flood mitigation efforts include designated drainage areas and open space on floodplains.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Carrie Young. Governor Doug Ducey has appointed retired Arizona Supreme Court Chief Justice Ruth McGregor to head a special investigation into allegations of physical and sexual misconduct at the Arizona State Hospital. Three state executives have lost their jobs following accusations that severely mentally ill patients were sexually abused. The departures occurred after reports emerged detailing how allegations of misconduct went unreported and uninvestigated.
There's an excessive heat warning in effect for the Valley today. We'll see sunny skies and a high near 113 degrees. It's going to get up to 115 tomorrow.
KJZZ is supported by Fenimore Craig, a full-service law firm collaborating on new business ventures and technology startups for 130 years. FenimoreCraig.com.
It's mostly sunny in Phoenix and 100 degrees at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, even more candidates have jumped into the presidential race as Jeb Bush and Donald Trump are now running for the Republican nomination. Why do so many people think they should be president? And do any of the candidates have a particular appeal to Arizona voters? We'll talk about it. Also, Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton is only facing two official opponents as he runs for re-election. We'll talk to one of those opponents, Matthew Jetty. Plus, what's it like to take over the continuing adventures of one of Tom Clancy's creations? I'll ask Valley novelist Grant Blackwood. We start today's program with the Arizona Coyotes. After going into executive session yesterday, the Glendale City Council says it'll continue its legal battle with the Coyotes, but the city says it's still hoping to renegotiate a fair deal with the organization. So how does the NHL view this situation? With me to talk about that from New York is Bill Daly, Deputy Commissioner of the National Hockey League. Bill, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So how actively does the league have to follow this? Is this between the organization and the city first and foremost?
Well, first and foremost it is, and then the club's in a little bit different position than has been in prior years where we had to be a lot more front and center because we Initially, we're running the club while it was in bankruptcy, and then purchased the club out of bankruptcy. So we were kind of the direct owners. Now, obviously, the club has private ownership, and they're principally involved in the dispute. But as with all of our clubs, all 30 of our clubs, this is something that that affects anything that affects the interests of a club to the extent that this type of dispute does, we stay pretty close to.
So when the Ice Arizona Partners took over the ownership of the Coyotes, was there hope at the league office that the drama would be over at least for a few years?
Yes, there was. yes, unfortunately, that hasn't proven to be the case.
So how does the ownership percentage shift away from Andrew Barraway affect the situation? Is that sort of normal business that maybe those of us lay people wouldn't understand, or does that indicate some other issue we should worry about?
Well, at this point, that's just a proposed transaction. It really has nothing to do with the current dispute with the city of Glendale or the legal dispute, and really has no other impact on the day-to-day operations of the club. Even if it is consummated, it's approved by the Board of Governors, I don't anticipate any real change in the day-to-day operations of the Coyotes. Anthony LeBlanc is the president of the club. He runs the club on a day-to-day basis. Don Maloney runs the hockey operations side of things. So the club's in able hands currently, and the ownership percentages really have no effect on that.
Let me come back to that drama question again. I'm going to add extra drama to this question, Bill, so prepare yourself here. Has this been a nightmare kind of scenario for the league in the sense that when the Coyotes get attention, it tends to be for this kind of thing? Even a couple of years ago when they made the Western Conference Finals, it still sort of seemed to be, well, is this going to be able to keep the team in the market then? Is it frustrating to have this always hanging over it?
Well, I think it is frustrating. I mean, I think, the club has been privately owned now for two full seasons, and I think has made a number of strides on a host of levels forward. And I think toward building a very long-term future in the Valley, and things were despite the disappointing performance on the ice this past season, I think they've charted a kind of direction for the future, which involves kind of a top-to-bottom rebuild of the playing roster, and it's a very long-term vision for how this team is going to be competitive at the top of the league on a going-forward basis. So I think on a host of levels, they've made a lot of progress. This lease dispute kind of arose like entirely out of thin air from left field, so to speak, and it is frustrating because it's another distraction that this club doesn't need right now, particularly as it kind of moves forward and charts a course for the long term.
At least in a general sense, does the league trust the city of Glendale?
That's a difficult question, and trust is a hot button word. So I'm not sure I want to go there. I do think the city's actions were misguided. I think they're unlawful, and I think it's very unfortunate for the club and its fan base to have to deal with something like this for the reasons we've already talked about, which is things. Are moving in the right direction, are building toward a long-term future, and to have this thrown into the mix, really a baseless attack on the club and its management by the city for no apparent reason, it is frustrating.
It's here and now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A couple of minutes left with the Deputy Commissioner of the National Hockey League, Bill Daly. Bill, we've seen success from the Tampa Bay Lightning. They made the Stanley Cup Finals. You've seen teams in Los Angeles and Anaheim have success. So those teams can do well. Coyotes have struggled. We've talked about that. Now, how much of that do you think is specifically related to what had been that ownership instability? This market is not cursed, right?
I hope not. and we've obviously put a lot of time and resources into trying to create an environment where the team can be successful long term, build a business long term, build a fan base long term. And I think, it has some remarkably resilient and passionate fans. Obviously, want to build that base. I do believe that this team can be successful long term in the Valley, and that really is the reason we've put so much effort into giving them an opportunity to be successful. And that's why, you know, certainly for the years we own the franchise, you know, that they're, by definition, that type of situation creates instability. And, you know, once we were able to transition the ownership to private individuals, again, I think we created a situation where the club could grow and be successful, and that's why this is kind of another handicap or obstacle or hurdle to their ability to do that and turn the corner. So the sooner we can get this resolved and behind us, the better.
And Bill, the league could have sold to someone who would have moved the team out of the market. So I guess that proves something. You didn't want to do that.
Correct. And we, you know, that fortunately, currently the National Hockey League has a number of options available if we were to expand or needed to relocate a team. There are cities capable of supporting NHL hockey, and there are owners interested in owning NHL hockey franchises. So that puts us in a good position. That was not an option we pursued for this franchise because, quite frankly, we had made a commitment to the fan base in Phoenix, Glendale area. We wanted to, again, you don't make a judgment on a market in the facts that we were presented with there, because those aren't the facts that can create really a fair chance. And we wanted to give this club a fair chance, and we still want to give this club a fair chance to be successful in the Valley. We think it can be.
Bill Daly is Deputy Commissioner of the National Hockey League. Bill, thank you for the time.
My pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. With more on the Arizona Coyotes situation, I'm joined by John Shannon, Canadian sportscaster and a panelist on Rogers Sportsnet's Hockey Central. Hi, John. How are you?
Hello, Steve.
So what do you make of the continuing travails of the Coyotes? Do you shake your head about this?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there are sides to the story that those of us that don't live in the market probably don't understand. At the same time, there are those of us that have a little bit of sympathy for what's gone on for hockey fans in your area, simply because I think there's a lot of us that believe in the market and believe that the NHL is sustainable in Phoenix, and what it needs is some stability, which doesn't ever seem to have, and needs a winning team, which they got a glimpse of a couple of years back, and we saw the indicators that said it could stay there then.
But John, why do you think this can be a successful market? Obviously, there are some loyal fans here, but what are some of the elements that make you optimistic about that?
Well, market size alone, I think when you talk about a quality of an arena, I mean, I think I'll call it the Glendale Arena for fear of pronouncing Gila River improperly.
Well, you got it right. You got it right.
There, yeah. Okay. I think there are lots of positives when you consider what goes on. Phoenix and the Valley of the Sun is a fantastic sports market. And I do believe that it qualifies as, you know, for teams of the Big Four. And as fickle as sports fans have been in your area for not just the Coyotes, let's face it, for the baseball team and at times the Cardinals, I think that hockey, once people get introduced properly to it, without the politics, without all of the other fringe issues, I think people will react positively to it.
John, when we look at Tampa, which made the Stanley Cup Finals, and I don't know if these are comparable markets. Phoenix is a little bit bigger, but they're sort of similar in terms of sports markets in a lot of ways. Is there a reason to think that Phoenix can succeed in the way that Tampa has? Because one thing that we've seen that's different, at least, is that Tampa has an owner with really deep pockets, and the Phoenix, the Coyote situation always seems to be, well, these are obviously very wealthy people, but not quite at that level.
I think a better comparison for my liking is Denver. And dare I say that Denver went through this same issue in the early 80s and lost its team. And only for the fact that there was some wisdom in the mid-90s did they get a team back, and the team has been proved to be sustainable. the key thing in all of that was it was a winner. Mm. And in 1996, when they moved there from Quebec City, they won the Stanley Cup, and it has become part of the mainstay of Denver. Tampa's a different... To me, there probably are some comparisons when you consider the size of the market and the demographics of the market. But at the same time, I think this is where Bill and Gary, who I listened to part of Bill's interview, I think where Bill and Gary are adamant in trying to stay there simply because they don't want to lose a quality market. And the patience that other owners haven't had, and the amount of changeover in owners that have existed, whether it be at the downtown arena or out in Glendale, I think has been one that has not helped the franchise and its stability and therefore its perception in the marketplace.
John, in reality, though, if this Glendale situation continues and there continues to be this battle and the fight between the organization and the money and whatnot, when there's truly a situation there where they don't trust each other, at what point do you think it does make sense for the NHL to kind of flex its muscles and say, we really want it to work here, but maybe we just need to have a fresh start somewhere else?
Hey, that's a great question. And I will tell you, Steve, I have been shocked to a level of the aggressive nature of the public statements between both sides, simply because I'm not sure in the end that's the way to get it done. That's the aggressive nature of the discussions by the city, the aggressive natures by Anthony, and then Bill and Gary. That to me has been a bit of an eye-opener in the fact that you think discretion would be the greater part of valor. You know, work behind closed doors and get it done. Quite frankly, the National Hockey League does its greatest work behind closed doors and is always very successful when it's discreet. So to me, this has been over the last two or three weeks, and the public statements have been a bit of a surprise to me.
I'm definitely not pushing the Coyotes out of the Valley, so anyone listening right now, I'm not encouraging this. But, John, are there certain markets that would make sense? We keep hearing Seattle, Kansas City. We've even heard Hamilton. And other than Seattle, those other markets are much, much smaller than Phoenix. Does anyone make sense in terms of what the National Hockey League is looking for if, in fact, the move is made? Purely hypothetical.
Well, I have always been an advocate for Seattle. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and I remember going to minor pro hockey with Seattle and Phoenix in the same league. That's how old I am. But from that perspective, I believe Seattle will be a viable market. What I don't believe is that Gary Bettman wants to relocate a franchise to Seattle, and he would rather have expansion money. Kansas City has proved that their arena is sustainable without the NHL. And they claim that they don't need the NHL. So I would not put them high on the list, and I wouldn't put Hamilton on the list at all, simply because the arena there would have to have a renovation of almost $250 to $300 million to become an NHL rink. And yes, you're right, it's a smaller market, but you know us Canadians, we love to spend our money on hockey, and it would do just fine in Hamilton if it ever got there.
John Shannon, Canadian sportscaster, a panelist on Rogers Sportsnet's Hockey Central. John, fun to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Steve, my pleasure, and I am one of those guys that believes that Coyotes will and should stay.
Okay, thanks again. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the presidential candidates and who might be a fit for Arizona voters. Also, we'll meet Phoenix mayoral candidate Matthew Jetty. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Area Agency on Aging, delivering home and community-based services, supporting family caregivers, and protecting elders for over 40 years. Donation and volunteer information at aaaphx.org.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. We'll have BBC News Hour today at 1. Well, sunny skies across the state right now. It's 80 degrees in Flagstaff, 92 in Prescott, 100 degrees in Casa Grande, 99 in Tucson, and 101 in Yuma. Taking a look at valley traffic right now on I-17 southbound up north of the valley, the shoulder is blocked by a crash at Happy Valley Road. Special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Jessica Jones and Richard Taylor, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. We've got an excessive heat warning today in the valley. It's sunny and now 103 degrees in Phoenix at 1123.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The list of presidential candidates has gotten even longer in the past couple of weeks as Republicans Donald Trump and Jeb Bush and Democrat Martin O'Malley have decided to jump into the race.
I am officially running for president of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again. I will be the greatest jobs president that God ever created. I tell you that.
Our country's on a very bad course. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? The question for me is, what am I going to do about it? And I've decided I'm a candidate for president of the United States of America.
Recently, the CEO of Goldman Sachs let his employees know that he'd be just fine with either Bush or Clinton. I bet he would. Well, I've got news for the bullies of Wall Street. The presidency is not a crown to be passed back and forth by you between two royal families.
Those were in reverse order, Martin O'Malley, Jeb Bush, and Donald Trump. They are all now among the 19 candidates who could be elected president in 2016. With me now is a person who I don't think has ever considered running for president. That's former state lawmaker, head of Copper State Consulting, Stan Barnes. Stan, good morning.
Hey, thanks for the introduction, and don't be so sure about that.
Well, you've probably thought about it. Hopefully you thought better of it. So what makes someone run for president? We heard Donald Trump, and what is it about this?
Well, I mean, I think it's simply the most important job ever in the history of humankind, and especially in the modern world. And so if you are a person of giant ego, giant resources, giant energy, and are willing, it's the highest prize there is. And I don't think you can hold it against anyone of that nature, that if you want to go as high as you can on the ladder of what is thought of as success in life, then that would be the pinnacle.
I think one of the things that strikes me, even about the clips we just played, what about these crowds? Are they genuinely that enthusiastic about these candidates with the cheering and the hollering? I can't think of that many things I'd be that enthusiastic about, let alone Donald Trump running for president.
Yeah, if you're going to show up at an announcement like this, you are bought in to the family, and you know that your job is to be there and to do that. I was lucky enough to stand next to John McCain while he announced for president in 2000, the first time he ran, and in New Hampshire. And I knew, it didn't take a rocket scientist to understand that my job was to applaud wildly and to be enthusiastic about my guy. And so that's the nature of things. But it's all optics. And I remember being struck at the time in New Hampshire about there was a crowd, and it was a large crowd. And on television, it looked like everyone in New Hampshire had gathered to watch John McCain announce. But in person, it wasn't that big, and it wasn't that dramatic. But it's all about the modern way of communicating all over the world. And so those moments are captured to plant the flag and to get people going one direction.
So since you're a Republican, I'll start this way. Who are the real candidates to you that have staying power on the GOP side? Who's your final three at this point?
Oh, that's a great question. And I don't think I've thought of it in those terms, but I'll take a shot. And I think Jeb Bush has got to be in the final three no matter how you cut it. When your brother was president, your father was president, and you were a governor, and it's there's no way he can't be in that final three in my world. I get that he has to wear that crown. I get that he's an establishment guy and all that, but this is the Republican Party, and we have that tradition, and he will have 100% name ID and a lot of money and a lot of that in his blood. And so I think Jeb Bush is a finalist. I think Marco Rubio is a finalist. That surprises me to say that to you today, because a year ago, and this is all floating, I thought Rubio just wasn't going to be that guy. But he is impressive on the stump. He seems authentic. His story is good. His youth, I think, is not too youthful in it, and it plays well. And his credentials are great. And he seems as much a regular person as you can be and be a U.S. senator from Florida and be in your early 40s. And so I give him a lot of credit. I think it's possible that the third one is John Kasich, who has not announced yet. He's the governor of Ohio, former congressman, and the kind of a blue-collar in style Republican who really connects well with hardworking people. And so I think he is going to do very well when he gets in. And then, you know, there's really an embarrassment of riches. I got to say that. I know that I'm biased, but Scott Walker and Rick Perry and Lindsey Graham and Carly Fiorina, even Rand Paul. I mean, there's a lot of flavors here. There's a lot of depth here. And I've said this before, but it reminds me, even though I was a young man, I was paying attention, it reminds me of what it felt like in 1976 when the shoe was on the other foot, when it was Gerald Ford versus a field of Democrats, because the Democrats knew the people of the United States were ready to change parties in the White House. And this is what it feels like today, with Hillary standing in for Gerald Ford in 2015 and a dozen Republicans who sense the American people are ready to go. You might get this year's version of Jimmy Carter come forward. It's a poxy analogy, I get that. But what I really mean is you might get someone you've never really heard of that breaks through the crowd. Forget Carter's presidency.
Right.
But you might get a Bobby Jindal or even a Scott Walker, who not a lot of people know, might emerge as the guy.
Stan, let's come back to your unofficial top three. I know I put you on the spot with that. Are those the same type of candidates you think would appeal to Arizona Republicans, or because that top three you mentioned is not, those wouldn't be considered the most conservative of the Republican candidates?
Yeah, that is an important question for us. I think those who are considered the most stridently conservative will wean themselves out, because I think most Republicans, including most Republicans in Arizona, have this unofficial dictum in their mind. They say, I want the most conservative guy that can actually win the general election. And Ted Cruz is not that guy. And Rand Paul is not that guy. And Ben Carson is not that guy. And Rick Santorum is not that guy. So you can take them off the list pretty fast that away, and come down to who's got enough conservative credential, doesn't want the government to grow big and wants to let the markets do their thing, but yet can still overcome that center-left majority that has been running the White House elections for and making it really close for the last 30 years.
Stan, one more thing for you then. And again, people listening right now, Stan is a Republican, maybe biased on this. I'm going to ask the question anyway. Any of the Democrats, whether Hillary Clinton, the juggernaut, or Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, any of those people breaking the chokehold that Republicans have had on Arizona presidential races?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Hillary's husband won Arizona in 1996. That was the only time Arizona has voted Democratic in the presidential election since 1948. Mm-hmm. And so Hillary would have the best chance, but I don't believe Hillary can win Arizona in a general election. I actually, a year ago, was telling anyone that would listen that Hillary was going to be the next president, because the Obama coalition, such that it is, plus what Hillary brings to the table in her gender and her identification with her husband, would put her over the top. I'm retracting that now. I think she's got enough pox on her with her Secretary of State doings, and when I see her on the stump, I start to think there's no way that woman is going to get a majority. But you know, it's up to the Republicans to put somebody up that can stand in there with her.
And as we know, these races are long, and there are a lot of ups and downs. Former state lawmaker, head of Copper State Consulting, Stan Barnes. Stan, thanks.
Hey, thanks.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Last Friday afternoon on the show, I spoke with a couple of people, Bill Scheel of Javelina Consulting and Phoenix City Councilman Sal DeCicio, about why Mayor Greg Stanton wasn't facing more opponents, whether high profile or not, in his reelection bid. The two candidates Stanton is facing are Anna Brennan and my next guest, Matthew Jetty. Jetty's probably best known for a 2010 run for governor and a 2012 congressional bid as a Democrat. And Matt Jetty joins me now. Matt, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, why run for mayor of Phoenix?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for bringing up those losses again back in 2010.
Noble losses.
Noble losses. I go down with the noble flames, as you will. I think the main reason for running for mayor is simply I think I'm the only one willing to address, pinpoint the main problems facing not only the city of Phoenix, but also the state of Arizona. And I have been since 2010. And it's not coaxed in a Democratic Republican kind of cloth. It's much bigger than that, and that's the role of government and what we trust in our government officials.
So let's get more specific on that then, Matt. What are some things that you think the city of Phoenix is not doing quite right that you think as mayor, you know, as a city manager sort of dominated system, what are some things you could change there?
Sure. I think that it's dominated by a city manager mainly because when Arizona was founded during the progressive era, so we didn't trust our elected officials anyway. So let's go ahead and put the hands or the power in the city manager. So because we can't wait 4 years to replace another person. But I think if we ask about light rail or pension spiking or taxes or even education, we're still missing the boat. We got to look at government on a much broader scale, much deeper, and that is in this context. We are accustomed to attach ourselves, detach, and reattach ourselves to what government ought to be. And government now has become one of many groups, not the main group, not the primary group, but a group. And those groups compete to maneuver government around. And then we become angry about it. We become angry at our government officials because we don't like what they're doing with it. But we've already missed the argument. I can sit here and talk about light rail. I can sit here and talk about pension spiking. And I think light rail is a great idea for a metropolitan area. Look at Boston, New York. But to do it for six more blocks at a time, I think you need a big idea, big future here for Phoenix. And Phoenix needs an identity. And we need light rail for individuals from Happy Valley and Joe Max area to take the light rail, come down and watch not the Coyotes. I hope the Coyotes ever come back to Phoenix. It'd be great. But to watch the D-backs, to watch the Suns, people need to commute back in. Right now, what's that benefiting on the light rail? And it comes to pension spiking. If my memory serves me correct, it was the city council, and I think minus one, that actually voted for the pay increase for the city manager, including our mayor. And so, and then to postpone that referendum to reform it is not making a decision that you need a decision to be made. But again, we're going back, we're missing the main problem of government.
When you talk about big ideas, that's interesting, because in many cases we hear those, and then once people actually practically get in office, they decide they don't want to try those things. Do you think there's momentum for big ideas, or does that momentum have to be created in a grassroots way?
Well, I think even when you say grassroots, we've already lost.
Okay.
Right. I think in you take a political science course 101, they say grassroots elections, they don't matter anymore in America. One reason is because, and I hate to say it, I apologize, but the media plays a big role here. And I think there's a definition of credibility. In the media's perspective, credibility means probability, likelihood to win. And the media really concentrates, and I heard it on, Politics Unplugged or Sunday Square, if one of the two, where one of the political consultants, like a drugstore analysis, if you will, says there's a million reasons why Greg Stanton's going to win. Well, you've already determined the winner then. Right, in terms of a bank account, right? And that is on credibility. I grew up, my father was a retired Marine Corps, two Purple Hearts, a Navy Cross. I grew up, credibility means honesty. It means trustworthiness. It means doing the right thing. And yeah, I switched parties back in 2010, back in 2012, because I don't think either party represents the voters.
Well, right, and this is a case where this is a nonpartisan race for mayor, so people won't get quite as bogged down.
It should be a nonpartisan, yeah.
Right, but you're running against an incumbent again with the big war chest, as we talk about. So, right. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. Whether right. that's fair to you or Anna Brennan or not, that's the reality of the situation. Okay. So going forward, how are you going to get your message out about, how are you going to get people to listen to you? And even, is there a case, Matt, I know you don't want to, you're not conceding here, I get this. Okay. But how important is it for you to get your ideas out there so that if you win or if you don't win, whoever the mayor is, take some of those into account?
I think it's a great point. I think one way to address that is, one, how do I get the message out? That's just knocking on doors. That's just literally meeting people and handshaking your way to the office, right? And my thumb still hurts from arthritis, how many hands I've shaken over the past couple of months, but that's what it takes. I'm not going to be that candidate on Facebook or Twitter saying everything I'm doing every day. I'm out there actually talking with the people around coffee tables, kitchen tables, dining room tables, addressing the real problems facing the city of Phoenix. And I hope, regardless if I win or lose, I hope that we can readdress what the main problem here is moving forward, and that's our viewpoint of government. Government used to be something that I can either rely on or something that I can use for the betterment of society. Now it's just a toy to put back and forth in Democratic and Republican hands.
I don't want to bring up the previous races in the sense that you didn't win them. That's not why I'm bringing this up. But those were really challenging races. You were going against Jan Brewer. You were going against David Schweikert. Now you're going against Greg Stanton. And I wonder, is there part of you that feels like these are the races where your ideas can get out more because they're such high-profile races? And I also wonder, I mean, are there things you think you could create more effectiveness on if you didn't run for office, because maybe you do get caught up in the horse race issues then?
I think it's a great question. I think let me answer it in two different perspectives. Over the past 2 years, I've been doing research on education in Arizona. I worked at some of the worst schools in the state, via even entire country, in terms of performance, not in terms of quality of kids, fantastic kids in these schools, but also, according to U.S. News, the number two school in the country. To compare and contrast what is wrong with education in Arizona and across the country, right? So, and I started a nonprofit organization called the People's Fraternity so we can address seemingly unsolvable problems, right? So I am doing things outside of politics, but on coming into this race, just like in 2010, my main issue in 2010 was healthcare and the economy. As you remember, what's happening in 2010, 2009, was going on. All of a sudden, April 23rd hits and SB 1070 takes over everything, including the media. And I was the only one that said no to SB 1070. I'm still behind that. That's a ridiculous law. I'm not saying we can't to protect the border. But to have a law like that is just ridiculous. But it goes to what I was saying earlier, what government's being used for, right? It's being, you know, back and forth. And then 2012, I ran against David Schweikert. But there's another story. That's for another day. But I switched parties. I think people want to know why I switched parties. Back in 2010, and remember, the Republican Party is really the first successful third party in American history. It's really the first successful one. And if you go back in history, look at Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, even Ronald Reagan, they all switched parties. They all switched their parties. So switching parties is not new in American history. In fact, some of the greatest leaders have switched their parties, right? And in terms of 2020, so I switched again. I had a family tragedy that took place, and the Democrats wanted me to use that in the election. And I said, no, I'm out, right? And that's why I switched. But no one knows that story. But again, we're going back to what the main problem is, and I hope we can make a difference either in this election or moving forward in Arizona.
Phoenix mayoral challenger Matthew Jetty. Matt, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet the Scottsdale novelist who's taking over some of Tom Clancy's characters. That's up next on Here and Now. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Center for Cancer Care. Specialists focus solely on breast cancer treatment technology and medical research in your own backyard. Available at 40 locations valley-wide. More at arizonaccc.com.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and kjzz.org. Taking a look at traffic right now on the southbound I-17, the shoulder is blocked by a crash at Happy Valley Road. Sunny skies today in the valley. It's going to be another hot one. 113 degrees for the high, up to 115 tomorrow. So stay inside if you can. Join us today at 12 for NPR's Here and Now. As Tropical Depression Bill makes its way across Texas, some parts of that state are finally emerging from years of devastating drought. And should college professors be allowed to date students? One teacher says yes. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon on KJZZ. It's mostly sunny in Phoenix and 103 degrees at 11:42.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Writing a series of novels takes a lot of creativity, skill, and luck. And when you're picking up someone else's characters and style, that increases the challenges. Scottsdale resident Grant Blackwood experienced success with his Briggs Tanner series, but now he's taking over the late Tom Clancy's protagonist, Jack Ryan Jr., in the new book, Under Fire. And Blackwood joins me now to talk about that. How important is your military expertise, your background, and how important is it to sound authentic? Do readers have those kind of expectations when they read a Tom Clancy book?
They do have those expectations. I think all thriller readers have that expectation, but in the Clancyverse, readers definitely have a high expectation of that authentic feel. And having served in the Navy for 3 years, doing, in fact, a lot of the jobs that Tom Clancy wrote about, especially in Hunt for Red October, I'm kind of steeped in that military mindset, and I think any veteran will tell you that that carries on through the rest of their life, the way they look at the world and approach challenges. So it's very much a part of who I am, and I think it served me well in these books.
In mentioning Hunt for Red October then, and you were serving in the Navy, when that one was published, what did you think of Clancy's writing? Did you get beyond the fact of this is an interesting thriller, I'm really drawn to this, or were you focused as well on the authenticity?
Both. I remember it was, as I said, I think a surreal experience, laying in my rack, which is what they call the little cubby holes they stick you in to sleep. I remember reading the book and kind of shaking my head and thinking, wow, he got that right, and maybe he shouldn't have gotten that right. But he did really a lot of things really well. And one of the gifts he had is making pretty complex subjects very accessible, and he did that well for his entire career.
You've been successful in your own right with your own characters. So what's it like, though, to be attached to Tom Clancy's name and characters that he basically created? Do you feel extra pressure, or is there just simply pressure of being a writer coming up with a good story, good plot, good characters?
I don't feel a lot of pressure very often. I'm, especially for this book, Under Fire and Dead or Alive, keenly aware of the monumental task of carrying this legacy along with Mark Greene, who has written other books in this franchise. But as I said, I'm so well steeped in not only just this culture, but having done a book with Tom himself, Dead or Alive, I felt I hit the ground running and I had a good solid foundation. So it was kind of my guiding force, just keep doing what I was doing and give the readers the best story I can.
Can you give us some quick background on how you came to be working with Tom Clancy or the folks who run Tom Clancy's estate, whatever the case is there?
Well, back between Dead or Alive publication and Teeth of the Tiger, which is really the debut book for the campus, I got a call from some people that I'd worked with before tangentially with Mr. Clancy's company. And they put to me the idea of working with Tom on Dead or Alive, and of course I immediately jumped at the idea. But I came into Dead or Alive with the book pretty much done. I mean, he did the characters and the plot and the story, it was all there, and it was a campus, and so I kind of played a free safety role. But to come full circle from reading Hunt for Red October in my rack aboard a frigate, to ending up writing with him was a dream come true.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with author Grant Blackwood. His new book is called Under Fire. It's part of the Jack Ryan Jr. series started by Tom Clancy, and he'll be appearing at the Poison Pen Bookstore tonight in Scottsdale. Grant, there's a certain intensity to the Jack Ryan Jr. books, and first of all, what's it like to write them? And do you need to get yourself to a certain place mentally and creatively to match the intensity that's found on the pages?
I think you need to do the right kind of planning. You really need to know what the story is about at its essence. And in this case, I kind of went into it knowing that Jack Ryan Jr. was going to be a very personal story with him. He was going to be dealing with his oldest and closest friend and some very volatile issues and areas of the country. And so once you get that groundwork, not country, world, once you get that groundwork and you know the essence of the story, the rest of it kind of falls into place. And you put in enough dicey situations, which is not hard to do when you're dealing with these kind of subjects, and you just go to the races and follow the story to the end.
I think I'm struck by the fact that, actors talk about method acting and getting themselves into a role. Is there such a thing as method writing when writing this kind of suspenseful novel?
There is. I don't know what I would call it, but that's a pretty good description of it. Going into this, I knew that Seth Gregory, Jack's close friend, was not only going to be disappear, but he was going to be accused of being a traitor. And this is a very person that's very, very close to Jack. And so how would you react if someone did that and said that about your close friend? And for me, it hit home, and I kind of knew, well, if I were Jack, this is what I would be all about. And that's kind of the drive he has through the whole story.
What do you think's been the appeal of the Jack Ryan character, now the Jack Ryan Jr. character? What is it that makes readers want to go back to it? I know there are some readers, you're drawn to a certain author, you're drawn to a certain character, you want to keep coming back. But these characters don't survive just on the same people reading them. You have to draw new readers. Why are they drawn to it?
Well, I think it's timely. You know, the campus and Jack Ryan Jr., they hunt terrorists and bad guys, and they do it kind of this shadowy world where the campus does and does not exist, and that's very appealing. And I think also Jack Ryan Jr. is younger. He's a younger character. And since Teeth of the Tiger, and especially Dead or Alive, when Jack made the transition from analyst to field operative, readers have watched him grow and evolve and mature and become a wholly different person. I mean, the core of Jack Ryan Jr. is there, but what he does and how he looks at the world is different, and I think readers have enjoyed that.
Grant, how much does the reality of the world, U.S. foreign policy, both play into how you wrote Under Fire, and how realistic within reason you've chosen to make the book? I mean, how much of it does it reflect real life?
It can reflect real life at you know, the drop of a hat. Tomorrow you could open up the newspaper and say, yeah, I just read about that in Under Fire. And that's kind of a hallmark of Clancy books. And we deal with topics that are torn from the headlines. In this case, it's about a volatile region, the Caspian Basin area and Iran. And, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what you shoot for when you look for a Clancy book, is something that really strikes a chord and you say, this feels very real.
Who are the best villains these days, and has that changed over the decades?
Well, it depends on the genre. The best villains, I think, are villains that have motives that you can clearly understand. The motivation for this bad person doing bad things is not a mystery to you. You might hate it, you might be repulsed by their motivations, but if you can see their objective argument about why they're doing what they're doing, that makes for a fascinating villain, I think.
Grant, one final question for you. Again, sort of the real-life reflection of things. Has anything changed now that polls indicate Americans are tired of real wars in Afghanistan, Iraq? Now, of course, what's going on with Syria? And does that affect how excited readers are about the books?
I think there's a through thread for these books, that whether it's a hot war or a war involving a larger nation, it doesn't really matter, because there is always this undercurrent. There's always bad guys. There's always people that want to hurt America and the Western world and a variety of assets and interests. And so there will always be Jack Ryan Jr. stories out there, whether or not there's a hot war going on. And that's just the nature of the world, and it's the nature of these kinds of books.
Grant Blackwood is the author of Under Fire, featuring Jack Ryan Jr., from the creative mind of Tom Clancy originally. And Grant has taken that character and made it his own. Grant's going to be at the Poison Pen tonight in Scottsdale. Grant, thanks for the time.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. ASU's baseball team has produced a roster of Major League Baseball all-stars and legends over the years, like Reggie Jackson, Barry Bonds, and Dustin Pedroia. But it's rare that a college baseball head coach moves on to become a Major League Baseball manager. Yesterday, though, the San Diego Padres decided to hire ASU's former head coach Pat Murphy to be their interim manager. Jeff Metcalf of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports covered Murphy during his time with the Sun Devils and joins me for a couple of minutes. Jeff, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
So how successful was Pat Murphy at ASU, and ultimately, why did they part ways?
Well, he won more than 600 games at ASU. He was there 15 years after being at Notre Dame. And they parted ways basically because there was an NCAA investigation into the program that found some major violations, which ended up with them having a one-year NCAA probation and some other sanctions. And at one point during the rather lengthy investigation, they basically fired him. And this was right before the 2010 season. And then he moved into pro baseball after that.
So when you were covering him, Jeff, did he seem to have designs on a major league job? Did he seem to be a fit for the major leagues even back then?
You know, that's a funny thing, because I don't think if this investigation had happened, I don't think he would have left ASU. He really loved ASU and was proud of his accomplishments here. And if you look at his record and accomplishments from about 2003 through 2009, it really was a golden age for ASU baseball. Next to the one when Bobby Winkles won three championships, leading into the Jim Brock era, probably as good an era as ASU baseball has ever had. They went to the World Series three times during that period and probably should have gone a fourth time and arguably maybe should have won a championship in there too. But I don't think if the investigation happened, I don't think he would have gone to pro baseball. So it's been kind of interesting to see how this has all worked out for him.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I also wonder, too, I wasn't in the clubhouse, I wasn't in the locker room, so I'm not sure, but there was talk that as great a coach as he was, you know, he had certain personality quirks, as we all do to some extent. And I wonder sometimes if some of those quirks work better with college kids as opposed to pro players. Any insight on that, Jeff?
I think he worked really well with college players. What I think he didn't work so well with was the NCAA regulations and meeting every little requirement that the NCAA required as far as record keeping, you know, every little recruiting rule. I think he understood the NCAA regulations, but I think there were some that he didn't feel were particularly important. And to a certain degree, I think that caught up with him when they had the investigation. So I think it's actually much more freeing for him to be at a pro level where he doesn't have to deal with all that, but he still has sort of that player rapport that he had with his college players. It seems to be translating at the pro level, too.
So last question for you then, Jeff. Do you expect him to be successful, and if so, do you think this is where he's going to stay and he's going to be a Major League Baseball manager for years to come?
Well, he has the job on an interim basis right now. He's been moving up kind of in the Padres organization for several years now, and I think it was sort of headed this direction that he would get this opportunity. Getting to the Major League level is a little bit different, and it'll be interesting to see if, because he's such an outgoing, outspoken individual, kind of a real free spirit that sometimes is a loose cannon, if you want to put it that way. Whether that's going to work at the Major League level, I think remains to be seen. I haven't seen a lot of Major League managers that are really like that. So, you know, I don't know if he'll tone it down a little bit. I kind of doubt it. That doesn't really seem like that to me. I think it's sort of a take it or leave it. This is who I am. And, you know, we'll see if he, you know, they've got so much talent that they acquired in the offseason with the Padres. They're expecting a lot there. So I don't know quite what they're looking at to take him from an interim level to the permanent job.
Jeff Metcalf of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports. Jeff, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Nearly 2 million people in the U.S. have had a limb amputated, and that number continues to grow as more soldiers return from overseas. Many amputees played sports before losing an arm or leg and are still passionate post-amputation. Last fall, we introduced you to the new Stand Up Amputee Basketball League at the Sports and Fitness Center for Persons with Disabilities, or SPOFIT, at 5025 East Washington in Phoenix. Coming up on Saturday, beginning at 9 a.m., SPOFIT will host the first-ever Stand Up Amputee 3-on-3 Basketball Tournament. And joining me for a couple of minutes to talk about that is David Banks, who came up with the idea of Stand Up Amputee Basketball. David, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So remind us, why did you want there to be Stand Up Amputee Basketball, and what are the differences between that and wheelchair basketball?
Well, you know, it's just initially, I wanted it only because, there really wasn't an opportunity for stand-up basketball. I'm a high-activity amputee, and the only opportunities afforded to me for basketball at a competitive level was wheelchair basketball. So I felt there was a need for it, and it's really how it got started. And fortunately, as the months went on, I've been introduced to a lot more amputees who are really excited about the opportunity, and it's really growing rapidly.
Yeah, I was wondering, we talked to you last fall, so things are proceeding. You've got more players, and obviously enough to have a 3-on-3 tournament.
Absolutely. We've got it's an amazing turnout. The event is Saturday at 9:30 a.m. at the Virginia G. Piper Sports and Fitness Center. We actually have teams coming from all over the U.S., So we actually have a couple groups flying in, you know, some guys from California, New Jersey, New York, Chicago, Philly, I mean, all over the country. So it's geared up to be a good event.
Now, David, tell us about a little bit about your experience and how long did it take you, I guess, to adjust to being a competitive athlete with a couple of limbs with which you were born and then move on to become a player as an amputee? I mean, obviously you had certain skills. Some of those translated, some of those didn't, right?
Yes. I've always been an active guy, you know. I mean, I played all, you know, various sports as an able body. And it's just, it took a while. I mean, it's not an easy transition, but, you know, I'm very stubborn and motivated. So I, you know, for me, I just wanted to get back to life as usual. So I've been able to do that. But there are a lot of patients out there that don't have that transition or I should say don't handle the transition as easily. So I'm actually a patient advocate. I work for a company called the Limb Center here in the Valley. And I actually work, they're a prosthetic company here in the Valley, and I actually work with them as a patient advocate, just working with the patients post-amputation, because that's the biggest thing, is having that inspiration. After you lose your leg, you have nothing but doubts and unknowns. You're not sure what's going on in your life or what's going to come next. So just having someone who can come in, standing on their two feet, who can give you some inspiration, it just really helps at that stage in their life.
David, we've got less than a minute to go, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, you know, how kids can adjust to these things. I know that obviously you have to be focused on what you're doing, you have to be focused on helping others, but is there a way to make that work for kids who perhaps, I mean, I imagine for kids it must be a real tough challenge as well.
It is for kids, but, you know, generally children and, you know, and the younger kids are more resilient because they don't know anything else. I mean, I meet a lot of kids and people all different ages, but the kids seem to be just tougher, more resilient. It's all they know. They have more energy. And, I mean, the kids and young ones I meet, they seem to just handle it and just tackle this disability. So, I mean, it's...